AM directional antenna proof of performance. We just got program test for a brand new station with a six tower DA2, and this is how thick the proof was. For comparison, here's a five tower from a couple of years ago under the old rules. Technically, the new rules aren't effective yet, but we asked for a waiver. We figured if they turned us down on the waiver, we would file it again when the rules are effective. But they're coming. It's a matter of reaching a date that keys off of the date it's published in the Federal Register, the notice of the new rules. It all started back in 1989 when five of the engineering firms that do a lot of proof of performance work kind of decided they had had enough and that they had seen enough advances in instrumentation and computer modeling that it should be possible to simplify proof of performance work, perhaps in many cases to the point of using internal measurements and proof of performance of a more sophisticated antenna monitor sampling system to replace the field strength measurements of a conventional proof. They jointly filed a petition for rulemaking. I think it was December of 89, wasn't it, Ben?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. Well, 11, more than 10 years ago. Well, my firm, Ben's firm, and the firm Bill Sufa was with back when he was an engineer before he became a business executive, all were among the five. Years went by before the commission did anything with it. They came out with a notice of inquiry about 93, I believe, and comments came in, and then things sat dormant for several more years. And they came out with a notice of proposed rulemaking. That was in late 99, I believe, early 2000, I don't remember which, where they basically said, we don't want to talk about moment method modeling and different kinds of sampling systems right now, so we're not going to get into that. But we do believe we can simplify the field strength measurement requirements for a full proof of performance. And they came out with some specific proposals to somewhat reduce the number of field strength measurements required and radials and so forth. Comments came in on that notice of proposed rulemaking. A lot of very constructive comments came in on how their proposal for minimizing field strength measurement requirements could be fine-tuned and tweaked so that broadcasters would more easily be able to proof their antennas and the commission would be able to better know that the antennas are functioning properly than is possible under the old way. And a significant number of new parties showed up who were interested in talking about the moment method modeling option again. So the National Association of Broadcasters was instrumental in starting a committee of industry people, consulting engineers, manufacturers, and people from the broadcast industry to discuss those possibilities and try to develop some joint comments. At the conclusion of that, comments were filed, and a number of other parties had filed comments in that rulemaking. And the commission took that all in and decided to bifurcate or split the proceeding up. They decided that there was merit in considering proof of performance standards that might not require field strength measurements in some cases, but that they hadn't seen enough evidence to satisfy them to go into that area and make rules. So they've created a further notice of inquiry to consider how computer modeling and improved sampling system technology could be used to make proof of performance requirements lessened or eliminated in some cases. But for all stations, they went ahead and made rules that simplified the field strength measurement proof of performance process quite a bit. And they dealt with both full proofs and with partial proofs. And the main focal point this morning will be the application of the new rules that have already been made. And there will be you know, some mention of what's going on in the further notice of inquiry also. I imagine some of you would be interested in that and might even want to participate in that rulemaking by filing comments. The panelists this morning are Ben Dawson and Bill Sufa. Ben Dawson, I happen to know, I think took his mother's radio apart when he was about 6 years old, and then got in the telephone business. I think by the time he was 10, he had a telephone system running in his neighborhood, so he had an early interest in telecommunications. He got a lot of radio experience at the local stations in his hometown and at the student station when he was in Harvard, and thereafter went on to be a group chief of a station that owned radio and television station, or company that owned radio and television stations. And what year, Ben? About 1978, founded Hatfield and Dawson?
73. I can't remember. It's too long.
With Jim Hatfield's father. And they've continued to practice engineering out in Seattle ever since. Bill Sufa, I happen to know, had built a television camera from scratch when he was in high school. And he went on to Virginia Tech to earn an engineering degree and worked as a field inspector in the New York office of the FCC for a time, and then went into the consulting business in Washington with Jules Cohen and Associates and later his own firm. And then since has gotten a business degree and has moved on to be an executive with J-Core and now Clear Channel Communications. So Ben comes on first. Then it'll be my turn again.
We decided we'd let Bill go last because he's got the most formal education.
That's right.
Ron showed you the copies of the paperwork that used to be necessary and will be necessary under the new rules, and it's a real significant difference. I did a real rough page count of those two documents, and you can see that, you know, that's over 3-to-1 difference in just simply page count. The wear and tear on your psyche attempting to put one of these together to meet some kind of a deadline because the ownership didn't allow you to do the construction until the CP was almost up is well worth that reduction in paperwork. The rulemaking essentially provides these major simplifications to the full proof of performance process. That's the first verification of the performance of a new antenna, or the complete verification of performance of an antenna that's been in some way or even a major readjustment. And they're really pretty significant, especially for more complex arrays. The required number of measurement radials can be as few as 6 radials. The distance reduction in measurement distance more than 2-to-1, down to 15 kilometers. The minimum number of points is reduced by a few percent to 15. And the proof of performance measurement maps for the entire measurement process no longer need to be filed with the 302 application, all at the station's transmitter or control point. The commission's informally accepted 302 applications without filing the maps for the last year or two anyway, so this is a pretty natural change. But it's a big difference in workload because the problem of drafting those ketchup stains and fold marks off the maps, not to mention the obscene comments of some of the itinerant field strength measurement takers, has been a real task. On top of which, no one I know has in-house a machine that will do the reduction necessary to get the darn things down to page size, so you got to send them out to somebody who does that. And it ends up costing a couple of $100 that's really money not particularly well spent because the reduced maps are reduced so far that they're not readable anyway. And, in fact, the only real purpose they ever served that I could see is that John Sadler used to put them up on the wall of his office and make sure that at least you drew the radials correctly on all the maps. The partial proof of performance simplifications, although kind of lesser in number, may, in fact, be the most significant change that this rulemaking has brought about. because instead of having to repeat measurements on all the measurement radials that were included in the original proof of performance, it's now necessary to include the measurements only on the monitor point radials, and if there are less than four monitor point radials, a minimum of four. And the total number of points to do a partial proof is reduced by 20% to 8. And this is a really significant difference in build-up urban areas. If DA, non-DA measurements are made as a part of the partial proof, new points can be selected on a radial. This is a really significant change, and it's really important because of the increasing urbanization of America, especially in the suburbs that AM transmitter sites are located in that used to be farmland and open country and are now full of Walmarts and 7-Elevens. Problem is, I once had to make select a new monitor point for a station in the Bay Area. I ended up having to look at 11 different points on the original proof of performance in order to find one that was satisfactory as a monitor point. And speaking of monitor points, if a point from the original proof is used, new measurement data only on that point will be required to establish a new monitor point. If a new point is used, a point that wasn't included in the original proof of performance, then the eight measurements on that affected radial have to be taken to show that the radial itself is within the limits of the standard pattern. Commissions informally let people get away with that in the past, but it was never in a way that was very well known so that they didn't get inundated, I think, with that kind of request. And the little route map that we used to draw of how to find the monitor point, you know, turn left at the Purple Cow and take 18 steps over the open sewer into the farmer's field, taking care to avoid his obstreperous billy goat, are no longer required. Although, of course, the measurement maps that were included as a part of the proof or a partial proof if you've made new points, once again, does have to be maintained at the transmitter site of the facility. The most important thing for the future of AM radio, in my opinion, is that the committee was a sound technical basis for and that there was fairly widespread agreement in the engineering and scientific community, issued a further notice of proposed rulemaking on the use of computer modeling to predict antenna performance. And Ron and Bill will both have something to say about this, but work on a number of directive arrays put into service or readjusted outside the jurisdiction of the FCC in the last 15 or 20 years, and nobody else has ever used the kind of measurement verification requirement that the Commission has used. Not really necessary, and magnetic field measurements made in urban environments especially are really not a terribly reliable way to categorize the performance of an antenna. Here's what the proof of performance required items look like from a traditional full proof of performance. The things that I've put in blue bold on that are things that either the rules have required, the FCC's 302 form is required, the commission staff has required, or there's some other, didn't file it with the commission with the 302, sometimes you'd get a deficiency letter or a phone call asking you to do it. The antenna system diagram requirement, for example, went out of the rules several years ago, three or four at least. Yet, I've recently filed a 302 without one, and insisted that I had to file it. Rather than argue with them, I filed it. All of those items are of some significance, and probably in performing a proof, even under the new rules, most, if not all of those, are going to be a part of the process, filed any longer. And Ron's got some suggestions on how to maintain data and make sure that you can go back 6 or 60 years from now and verify what's going on. This is a typical construction permit, which has been, as the lawyers say, redacted, so you can't see where it is. But you can see that most of the things that I've actually blacked out on this are the items that specify the particular facility that are different on each construction permit. This one does have the average hours of sunrise and sunset, despite the fact that this is a DA1. Every one of those blacked out areas is a place where the commission staff routinely makes erroneous entries. And on the bottom of this are the parameters for this particular antenna system. This one actually happened to have them all correct, but it didn't have everything correct. Like all construction permits, it lists the azimuths and the radiation values on the radials on which monitor points need to be established. The Commission's policy has always been to put those on pattern inflections, that is to say, places where there's a minimum or a maximum, that is, the sense of the vector changes. When we looked at this one, we said, this isn't right. There are at least two of those that aren't on places where the pattern actually has minimum or maximum. So Tom Gorton in our office wrote a letter to Ann Gallagher, who happened to be the person who worked on this CP when it was originally granted, and asked her why two of these radials were where they were. Here's the answer we got. Mr. Lubetsky insisted that for some reason the 125-degree point, 125-degree radial needed to be at 125 degrees, and we looked at the problem. Here's the 302. This is the traditional paper 302, and we're going to get a new 302 for electronic filing, and we don't know what it looks like, but it's going to contain much of this same information. We hope it's not as awful to fill out as the Form 601, which is the form from hell. And we hope it at least has a place where we can put some kind of comments for anything in here that's unusual or irregular. But the 302 itself is really not going to change in any substantive way with electronic filing. Here's the antenna pattern for the construction permit I just showed you. And you can see that this pattern has a set of nice minima and one great big maxima and three little tails out backside. Here's the tabulation of them. It's a reasonably tight 50-kilowatt pattern. Here is the map key for all the maps that would have had to have been included with the construction permit, I mean the license application for this station under the traditional 34-kilometer full set of radials measurement process. Here's what the new rules will require. Only half as many maps are involved, and two less radials are involved for this particular antenna system. You notice that it's still got the 125-degree radial there, even though it doesn't really correspond to any feature of the pattern because of my aforementioned judgment that it was more trouble to argue than it was worth. Here's an example of a relatively simple two-tower pattern. This one has some personal historical significance. This pattern was just destroyed by an... Nonetheless, this is a fine two-tower, wide-spaced, two maxima and two minima, and a little tail off the backside and a dip in the front kind of pattern. Only thing simpler, really, is a two-tower cardioid, probably. Here, so you can see that at least six monitor points are going to be required. Six measured radials are going to be required for this array under the new rules. Under the old rules, eight radials were required. And I think actually when they proofed this thing out in 1937, I think they actually had nine radials on it, but I couldn't find my copy of the old proof real fast. The measurement radials would have looked something like this were we to proof this all over again according to the old rules. Once again, a little less than half the number of maps required and two fewer radials required for a new full proof on this array. That is something like a 3.5-to-1 reduction in the total number of measurement points. Significantly decreased workload both in the collection of the measurement data and the preparation of the proof of performance. Doesn't change, of course, is the fact that the work necessary to establish the proper performance of an antenna really doesn't change. You still have to tune it up and make it work. But in the past, that's all, you know, the question of whether or not the array works is the judgment of the person who is making it work. And as my partner, Mr. Hatfield, often says, you've then got to go make the measurements and torture the data till it fits. Now I'm going to let Ron give you some detailed information about proof and partial proof requirements under the rules. So I'll turn it back over to Brother Ron.
Thank you for the informative discussion, Ben. I intend to just go through the details of the new rules step by step, and it might be a good time to take notes. We've spent quite a bit of time studying the new rules, and in some ways I feel like Santa Claus has come. First of all, for a full proof of performance, the major points that you need to know about: there used to be a minimum of 8 radials required for a proof, and most patterns other than simple two-tower pattern is 6 radials. Only 6 radials are required if you can catch all of the pattern features that they want you to with 6. They do have the requirement, they dropped the requirement for 3 radials in the major lobe of a pattern. They still lobe of a pattern. And they've added the requirement that there can't be more than 90 degrees of azimuth between 2 adjacent radials. Their policy used to be 60, but that was never published. But now you can have 6 radials, only 1 radial, as long as you can have at least 1 radial every 90 degrees and catch the nulls and minor lobes with radials to define the features of the pattern. You can do it with 6. If you're doing a proof efficiency, it's only necessary to run 6 radials also. For very complicated patterns, the commission took to heart a lot of the arguments presented to it that when you get beyond, you know, 10 or 12 radials, you have opportunity for errors to creep in and environmental factors to come into play and complicate things unnecessarily. Some of the larger arrays, it would not be uncommon to run 15, 17 radials on some radials. And with the simplification of less radials on major lobes and so forth, if you still get to more than 12 radials to catch all the pattern features, they'll let you assume symmetry. These large patterns usually have symmetry from one side to the other on some of the pattern features, and you pick the one where it's easiest to run the radial, and you can assume symmetry. That won't mean a lot to most stations, but for some of the larger arrays, it will mean a lot. They require a minimum of 15 measurement points per radial, and this gets a little bit confusing. If you start reading the rules, they say that you make measurements at a certain interval within 3 kilometers and then a certain interval beyond that. And if you add all those up, you might come to a few more than 15. But 15 is the minimum. They recognize that you don't go out and try to take measurements at exactly those intervals. Those are just suggestions for how they want to see the measurements grouped on the radial if possible. But the minimum they set was 15 measurements per radial. And it was not unusual under the old rules to have 30 to 40 measurements per radial, and, you know, almost always at least 25 or so. The old rules wanted to see 15 or 20 measurements within the first 2 miles or 3 kilometers. So this has cut down on the field strength measurement work required considerably. They do say they want to see at least 7 measurements within the first kilometer, 3 kilometers, excuse me. That replaced the measurements every, in the old rules, it was measurements every tenth of a mile. That's 2 miles, so it was approaching 20 measurements. So now it's 7. Those are the dreaded close ends, the ones you typically have to, everything, have guns pointed at you and everything else. So You can get in and out a lot faster now on those. They also cut the distance, maximum distance or minimum distance required for radio, 20 miles and then 32 kilometers. And now the radials only need be run to 15 kilometers. Now, in many cases, it's desirable to run measurements beyond that distance, especially with some complicated directional antenna patterns and some further out. But if you can proof your antenna with 15 measurements, 7 of them within the first 3 kilometers, the remaining 8 between 3 and 15 kilometers, and show that the pattern is in, that's all you need to file. And that's a lot less work than the old proof. Have to experiment and see which way this vector is pointing here. I think that the partial proof rules actually will mean much more to the existing broadcasters than the proof rules.
You need to go the other way.
Right? Do I?
Yeah.
Did I bounce one? That's where I want to be.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Under the old rules, you had to run a partial proof using the same measurement points that were used in the last full proof that was run on the DA. If the last full proof was run a long time ago and the environment had changed a lot, that wasn't necessarily the best thing to do, but it's what the commission rules required. There were people who had to run full proofs for the simple reason that there were no points left that were measurable and usable from the last full proof. The old partial proof rules required 10 points per radial, so a partial proof usually meant 10 points on 8, 10, 12 radials or more. The commission, among other things, said once a pattern's been proven and shown to work and make its efficiency, we don't really need to see measurements on all of the radials. If changes are made, if the pattern is readjusted or for some reason the parameters change and people need to establish new parameters for their license, we only need to look at the monitored azimuth, basically. So now, for partial proofs, they still require that you make measurements on radials that were run in the full proof, but you don't have to run all of them. They set a minimum of 4 radials. The radials are to be run at all monitored azimuths. If you have 4 monitor points on a pattern, it's a no-brainer. If you have a simple pattern that doesn't have 4 monitor points, they say that you should run additional radials as necessary and make those radials as close in azimuth to the monitored radials as possible. Reasoning, I guess, that you catch the backside of the other features of the backside of the pattern that way. If you have more than 4 monitor points, you're required to run all of the monitored radials. They've also dropped the requirement from 10 measurements per radial to 8 measurements per radial. And here's where it really gets interesting. They've tried to make the new rules as flexible as possible. And frankly, I think the commission realizes that there are a lot of stations out there that need fixing. And they want to promote that. So always in the partial proof rules, and that is ratioing the directional antenna measurements now to what the directional antenna readings were at the time of the full proof, and doing a ratio analysis and apply that ratio to the measured directional field at the field now. That hasn't changed. That's still allowed. They also specifically put in the rules a procedure that will let you measure directional readings now and non-directional readings now at the same point and use the non-directional field from the last full proof of performance in the analysis to arrive at what the directional fields are now. You do a radial average of the ratios and then apply that radial average to the non-directional field from the proof. And it's kind of like in a partial. Now, the commission has allowed this when people asked for it in the past, but it was never in the rules that you could do it. The advantage of the DA non-D analysis is that you can generally factor out a lot of environmental changes, especially ground conductivity changes. Run in August in, say, the north somewhere where the ground freezes, and you're trying to run a partial in February, you can get out 10 miles away from the array, and even though the antenna is functioning the same, measure 1.5 or 2 times the field. If you close the DA field, then that difference can wash out. That's why the DA non-D is useful, and that's why the commission had let people use it in the past. They like the idea, so it's in the rules now. But here's the big news. If you use a radial on a partial proof and come up with its radiated field now and use that in the analysis, even if it isn't the same radiated field that was the case in the full proof. And this is going to let a lot of people run partial proofs who would otherwise have to run full proofs. There are stations out there, a lot of the older stations never had the ability to switch to non-directional in their system in the first place. The people who tuned the pattern a long time ago may not have been real careful about detuning the unused towers and that sort of thing. And when you go back, when you try to do a DA to non-D analysis, some of the skeletons in the closet from the past show up, and there's really no good way to deal with them. If you go to the extra trouble of running the 7 additional measurements within the first 3 kilometers, like you do for a full proof, and graph those measurements on non-directional, like you do for a full proof under the new rules, you're able to come up with a new non-directional field for that radial and use it in the analysis of the partial proof. That's going to be a major improvement. And stations are going to benefit from being able to either make minor changes or make repairs and be able to run a partial proof and get a license much more easily than they could in the past. Partial proofs in the past basically were good for getting new parameters. If you changed out equipment, if you made a change on one of the towers or something changed in the environment and you cranked to a new set of parameters, ran a partial proof, showed to get new operating parameters. That was basically the use for a partial proof. Now, as I mentioned, you can use a partial proof to select new measurement points. You're not locked down to using the measurement points from the full proof anymore. Big changes in monitor point. If you had a monitor point that became inaccessible, you couldn't drive to it, the commission had a procedure in the rules that would let you make measurements on just the radial containing the monitor point, go find another monitor point that's accessible on that one radial, and if the partial proof showed that the radial was within the standard pattern, they would give you a new monitor point, the one you specified, and place a new limit on it based on the analysis of that one radial. If you had a monitor point go out of tolerance, because let's say somebody built a cell, and use that procedure to raise the monitor point limit on an existing monitor point. And that never made any sense, but the commission used the argument that, well, we don't know what the RMS of the pattern is if we don't make you run the full proof. Well, if you were moving a monitor, the commission has kind of reconciled this now. It's possible to raise the limit on a monitor point. It's also possible to pick a monitor point that wasn't even measured in the full proof. On a radial, find the most accessible point today. It doesn't matter whether it was measured in the proof or not, and establish it as a new monitor point. You can also change the monitor point limits of an existing point without having to run the whole partial proof. You can do a single radial rule, say, to analyze it and change the limit on an existing point also. So you can do both now, and you can do both with one radial measurements. And this is going to be big news to a lot of people. Under the old rules, if the allocation that didn't need to be pulled in as tight as the original pattern had been, if you readjusted and had trouble getting a null pulled in as tight as it had been in the past because of environmental factors, ran an allocation study, found that you're not going to interfere with anybody operating that way, but you just can't satisfy your standard pattern, you would have to file an application for construction permit, mathematically apply what they call an augmentation to the pattern, basically a little null fill over a span. You could also put patches on sides of minor lobes and so forth for those. But it required that you process a 301 application, get a construction permit, and run a full proof of performance in order to make that change. It's now possible to make that change on a partial proof. And that means that a lot of systems, they find that they have a monitor point that's out and that they aren't able to maintain their pattern, have the option of running an allocation study, seeing if the radiation could be out beyond where they find it, where they're able to adjust it, and to have their license changed, actually to change the standard pattern to allow that radial to operate where it is with only a partial proof. It does require the additional close-in measurements and the graphical analysis on the one radial that has the problem. You run the full proof type measurements on the one radial that you want to augment and demonstrate what the radiation is, and then you can apply for an augmentation without having to do the full proof. I think it'd be wise for anyone rehabilitating an old directional antenna that may not have operated properly for quite a while to look into the allocation factors before they start adjusting. I don't know how the consulting engineers are going to get all those allocation studies done, but it would be the wise thing to try. And there were a number of other things that didn't necessarily directly relate to proofs that the commission decided to do after looking at all the comments. You know, as you might imagine, there were all kind of issues floating around. This was a fairly wide-reaching rulemaking. The commission decided after hearing all the arguments from all sides that there would be no more critical directional antennas. There are only two or three dozen, I think, in the country, but those were supposed to keep their operating ratios and phases within tighter tolerances than the 3 degrees and 5% that were specified in the rules for everybody else. Those conditions were usually imposed as a result of a petition to deny wish to get the application granted rather than go to hearing, and they would put on requirements like you have to maintain your antenna monitor parameters within 0.9 degrees and 1.5% ratio, and you had to have a very complicated antenna monitor system that could. At one time many years ago, you had to have a first-class operator on duty at the transmitter side, and you couldn't go remote control. It was a serious thing for the broadcasters that had critical arrays. But there was a fallacy in it, and that is you can run a computer study and find that a tower with a ratio of 1.5 can move 0.9 degrees and cause the radiation to exceed the standard pattern at some azimuth. But then the commission would issue a license and put that tolerance on all the towers, even the ones with ratios of 0.5. And that was one of the things that was pointed out to the commission. If you're going to do it, you need to do it in a scientific way and put different tolerances on all the towers. And I think they just decided that would be more trouble than it was worth. There were a lot of other arguments that the overall allocation scheme is a statistical process in the first place, and that whatever errors result if arrays are allowed to have 3 degree and 5% tolerances wouldn't be a big deal anyway. But that was one for some people be a very major. Another, the commenters almost unanimously wanted to get rid of the requirement to have base current meters at the towers. They realized if you get new modern antenna monitoring equipment and put your sampling system in the way the FCC wants your towers are doing. And the commission, you know, originally before phase monitors, maintaining the ratios you would find on base current ammeters was it was really the only parameter you could monitor in directional antenna in the early years in the 30s. And it became dropped the requirement to read base currents on any regular basis in the early 70s. When they, for the stations that put in approved sampling systems with modern equipment and the type of sampling lines and pickup devices. As a result, as a consulting engineer, I can tell you I don't see too many stations where the base currents have been read in the last 20 years. You know, when you're working on it, you go down and knock the dirt dauber nest out of the way and all that and hope that they still work. And I think most people... So the commenters generally said either no base current meters at all, we don't even want to be required to have them, or if we're required to have them because it's a good idea to have a cross-check on the antenna monitor system, please don't hold us to the tolerance on the base currents, drop the tolerances. The commission elected, there's nothing wrong with having them. In fact, it's probably a good idea for maintenance purposes, but the commission is out of the base current regulating business with these new rules. It was always a requirement to measure the base impedance or common point impedance of a directional antenna over a sweep of plus or minus 25 or 30 kilohertz. And a lot of people, including the commission, thought that that was so they could look at bandwidth. But if you go back to the original documents, that was because the measuring instruments they had in the 1920s were not known to be accurate at any given point. So that was a way to statistically analyze measurements by taking them over a range of frequencies and drawing a line between them. They are handy, though, for understanding what should be expected in terms of bandwidth of a system and so forth. It's a good idea to do them. The commission decided, though, that they're in the business of knowing what power the station's operating with. All they need to know is the carrier frequency resistance. So the requirement to file the all of that impedance data with the proof of performance is gone. It has been standard practice, at least since the mid-1970s, when the pulse duration modulation transmitters first came on the market, to adjust the common point reactance to something other than zero. The commission rules had always contained a requirement that the common point reactance be zero. So you set your common point impedance to 50 ohms or whatever, and you have 0 ohms of reactance. The problem is you usually have a contactor or two and some tubing and strap and a transmission line between that common point and the actual transmitter terminal, things that introduce reactance. With the older transmitters, you simply adjusted the tuning control until you dipped the plate and looked at the efficiency, and that took care of it. With the modern transmitters that needed to see a 50-ohm load and for which loading misadjustment could cause distortion because of, you know, fooling with the pulse width and so forth, we found that we actually had to adjust common points to 50 minus J5, 50 minus J8 in order to have no reactance at the output of the transmitter, which I think is what the commission was trying to accomplish in the first place. All the commenters, I think, all agreed. I think one commenter had suggested a maximum be placed on the reactance, but we no longer have to ask for a waiver for the transmitter. And I really enjoyed writing the monitor point descriptions for this proof that we've done under the new rules, because they are one sentence long. If you've ever gone out checking monitor points, you realize some poor guy spent hours writing detailed descriptions of every turn you make from the transmitter gate out to each monitor point, and nobody reads them that way. Nobody drives back to the transmitter and drives back out to measure the next monitor point. The new rules simply say that you have to give a written description that'll let you find the point, and that can be a street address or whatever detail you need to know when you've arrived at the point to know precisely where it is. They also note that GPS coordinates can be used, but GPS coordinates alone are not sufficient. They want to see. And I think this is my last one. And eliminating the requirement that the field strength measurement maps be included in the proof report that's filed with the commission, and they also dropped some other requirements for some of the detail of how measurements are done or so forth. They imposed a requirement that this material be kept on file at the station so that an FCC inspector could make reference to it if necessary. And this is only a suggestion, but the last proof I ran that I filed under the new rules, I put together a ring binder to go up on the shelf with the transmitter instruction manual containing the things required by the commission and a few more. They require that the maps showing measurement locations be on file, and I believe I would suggest that this is a good way to do it, to keep the maps together. They require a schematic showing the impedance measurement points be kept on file at the station, and that will fit in there also. They require the impedance measurement methodology details. Basically, I use a block diagram showing the instruments that were used. So they have the block diagram showing the instruments, and then they have the schematic showing where you made the attachments to measure the common point base impedances. And the impedance measurement results. They don't require that you do the sweep and maintain those at the transmitter site, but if you do but they want to have the measured impedance that you supplied with the field sheet, so to speak, that you supplied with the proof on the 302 form. A few things we don't know yet. We don't know exactly what electronic filing of AMDA 302 starts. The commission is still working on that. I can tell you from my discussions with the commission that they want to simplify what has to be filed with a 302 electronically as much as possible. One suggestion that's being considered is that instead of filing field strength measurement graphs, tabulation of the analyzed field and the conductivities be provided in tabular form to minimize the number of PDF files. That could be loaded into a computer and a graph could be drawn using the technology that most people use today. I don't know whether they're going to do that or not, but that'll give you an idea of the further simplification they're looking at. So it's going to be a lot easier to proof antennas from now on. Bill, I think it's your turn.
A Q&A stuff. And actually, you're going to find me the more on the proponent side up here for further simplification for a lot of reasons. In part, I've never understood. I understand the history, but we as engineers and why the commission as a regulatory body has not embraced technology to simplify and eliminate the commission's past role of being, shall we say, a barrier to entry as opposed to an agency that's looking out for the public interest. One of my concerns is as I've moved roles here into Clear Channel's management ranks is economic considerations. As a point of reference, and I know AM radio is a relatively small piece of what I do, the cost of AM is substantially higher than most of the other things that we're doing. You wonder why people aren't building new AM arrays. Here's a point of reference. For a couple of million dollars, we can build an AM radio station. For that same couple of million, probably 50 or 60 new billboards up, generating new revenue within weeks. where it'll take a couple of years or more to get the AM radio station up and running. And to us, time is substantial money, especially in an investor-driven environment. If it's AM application processed, take another 6 months to build the antenna system, and another 3 months, 6 months, sometimes a couple of years to get it fully, sometimes in a couple of cases even more than that to get it fully licensed. That time is substantial money to us, and as we look at where to invest the money, we're looking at things that are accretive to our returns, which means it generates additional earnings for our shareholders. So it's as important to me what the time savings as it is the cost savings. The new partial proof of performance requirements, maybe a third of the cost of current one of the old proof of performance requirements, but a substantial time savings. Full proof of performance, half the present cost. I think Ron will tell you, because he did the array for us. We did a diplexed antenna system in Los Angeles 4 or 5 years ago, and I think we had that on the air under program test authority within 4 to 6 weeks of the time it was ready to turn on. In the old days, doing that kind of thing, and that was because Ron did numerical modeling, and we got a large crew of people in to do measurements and everything else. In the old days, that proof of performance probably would have taken six to eight months or more. Before we had it licensed and on the air. The difference on the revenue side was millions of dollars a month, as much as $2 million a month difference on the revenue side. So that's a big difference. In addition, we would have saved at least more than 50% on the proof of performance in that case if we were using the new rules. Going further, and the thing that I'm a big proponent of is moving to the moment method modeling, the internal modeling of antenna systems. If we go that far, we can cut the proof performance to maybe 10% of its present cost. Now, the trade-off to that is there'll be some increased costs in the construction of the array to put a little bit better antenna sampling system in and some engineering time on the upfront side to make sure it works right. But it saves us not only a lot of money, but an awful lot of time in getting it on the air and working. My point is, we're talking about trying to use modern technology, the same kind of modeling technology as is used in design of building structures. If you buy an FM directional antenna, chances are it will have been constructed and tested on a scale model range, and then it's assumed to work right once it's on the tower. What I'm saying is that with these numerical modeling techniques, we can eliminate a lot of the uncertainty, actually get a better performance measurement, cut the time and cut the cost. I don't understand why we shouldn't do it. I can't see either the economic argument for doing it or the philosophical argument for resisting that. The cost is an important driver. I'm pleased to see so many people in a room willing to talk about AM radio on a Wednesday morning. Clear Channel bought AM/FM. We closed on the purchase last year, and really it should have been named FM/FM given the number of AM radio stations that they owned. And the reason was simply economic. There's on the accounting side, or the finance side, there's a rule change coming that the accountants will put on their hats and talk about. I really don't want to get into very much other than to say it changes the way the broadcast industry will be measured by the financial community. And in the past, the broadcast industry has really not been measured on the amount of capital money we spent. Other than a cursory look saying, we've been measured on cash flow. How much cash flow can you generate from these stations? Well, in the new world, we're going to be measured on the depreciation of the physical assets that we have, and that will work directly against the cash flow earning incentive to minimize the costs of AM radio stations and minimize the cost of all our operations on the capital side since it moves that capital depreciation cost into an operating cost. So that, from the standpoint of the operators, the high capital intensive operation, what it'll do for the publicly traded companies is actually to make there be less incentive for AM radio to continue. I don't want to see AM die. I think it's still got a future. We at Clear Channel have invested heavily in it and actually make a tremendous amount of money with our talk radio programming. I'd like to see all the elements of this industry take a look at scientific technology, see where we can go and try and do what we can to improve our speed to market, improve our cost structure, and actually improve the interference protection to other stations. That's all I've got. Mine was short and sweet. Let's take some questions.
Yeah, punch the button one more time. There.
I guess it's my job to coax questions out of the audience. Or Ben, would you have any further words you would want to say? Maybe on something Bill has brought up.
The result of this is that because the partial proof process particularly will be simplified, I think there will be a lot more incentive for some of the younger engineers to learn a little more about AM, and I think that will be very helpful. We've run into a number of situations. As excellent engineering staff at a local ownership cluster of stations has just almost ignored their AM station, mostly because they just simply didn't understand its technical requirements. And they had to be prodded by corporate engineering management to bring their act up to speed, blur, and a little less intellectually arduous, or a little less intellectually intimidating, I think can be an incentive for some of the younger folks to, now that I'm getting to be an old guy, some of the younger folks to take on learning about their AM antenna systems.
Yes, I love teaching them, don't you, Ben?
Well, I'm here because I was taught by some awful nice, awful smart people. Well,
that actually may be one of the dying factors to AM is the fact that we don't have people who know how to design them or construct them or operate them anymore.
Make me feel good, Bill. Yes, sir.
This question doesn't relate so much to the deregulation of the proof of performance rules, but I would ask the distinguished panelists, they have any thoughts about the possible future deregulation to allow the use of passive radiators, that is, non-driven radiators in AM arrays.
That's an interesting old wives' tale. There's never been a rule of antenna systems in the United States, and there is a long history of the use of them.
Maybe by accident.
Yes. And it's absolutely flabbergasting to me when people bring this up, but there have been arrays licensed in this country for years with entirely parasitic elements.
But they didn't go to the commission.
Filed in the proofs of performance and shown that way. And the distinction is that the commission has never allowed anything to be used as an element in an array that wasn't monitored. So anything that's a completely parasitic element has to be monitored. But to my knowledge, has never been a policy against the use of a completely passive element in an array.
There are a lot of them out there. I'm not sure that the designers knew they were going to be passive.
Well, I mean,
you get the right
here.
There are plenty of them with resistors at the base of the towers.
Well, yes, sir.
I got a question. I read a paper about getting rid of phase cabinets with a digital type of phasing thing. Can you do that yet? Is somebody doing that or anything?
Nobody's ever done it. A paper was presented here a couple of days ago on that topic, and it's very interesting, actually.
It's a subject that's been raised many times.
It's not I think the digital control aspects of what this fellow's talking about are novel now. Mm-hmm. They're new, but the concept has been talked about a lot. In the 1970s, when Westinghouse developed the solid-state transmitters that RCA later marketed for a short while. You know, they said if we're going to be using lots of transistors instead of one tube, we can just put them in modules, and instead of the transmitter building, we can distribute them to the towers. that's been talked about for a long time, and as far as I know, it's perfectly doable as far as the FCC is concerned.
Actually, if you go back into the files, I don't know if it's working or not, if you go back into the files of the FCC, there was a station in Washington, D.C. with a three-tower array, and it was originally filed to have separate amplifiers at the base of each tower in the 1930s.
Was it built?
I don't, you know, I couldn't tell whether it was built or not, but it was certainly filed and approved that way originally.
I've made measurements on an array, on two arrays, actually, in the Middle East, that are four-tower arrays with two parasitics and two driven towers. And the two driven towers are each driven by a separate transmitter with no interconnection except the common oscillator.
But it's never, given the type of adjustments that have to be made here to maintain tight parameters and tight nulls, and you know, the fact that you would have to design from scratch, you know, one-of-a-kind system to drive all that, we've never seen one here, and I'm not sure we ever will. But it's a very interesting idea. If you want to build one, I think the FCC would be glad to let you do it.
If
you had enough money, right? Yeah. If you were doing that, though, you would need the full power, like for your daytime or whatever pattern, if you have a non-directional on that one tower, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have to have the ability to operate with all the modes.
Question concerning your measurement points. Assuming you have a GPS that you have set up for NAD, 83 true north reference, and it can measure within an accuracy of 20 feet. Once you get the GPS coordinate, what else is required in your description of the monitoring or the measurement point beyond that?
It's only monitor points you have to give descriptions for, and the commission entertained that argument. They said, yes, give us the GPS information, but we also want information on what you can see when you're near the point.
Actually, the description of a monitor point especially is really sort of up to the discretion of the person who figured out that was the right monitor point, because if you've got a monitor point where a very slight change in location makes a difference, then obviously you need to tighten the description down to the manhole cover type dimensions.
And I'd be as happy if the monitor points go away.
Well, yeah. You're just a radical, Bill. But on the other hand, you know, there are many situations in which, you know, the street intersection, for example, is a good enough description, and anywhere you go, you know, a few percent, 4 or 5% of the same, and then a real tight description isn't necessarily called for. The only other thing that's nice is that if the description includes enough information so that if there's some change in the circumstances around the monitor point, you can still figure out where it is. I had to change monitor point on an array not too long ago, a couple years ago, in which it was on a boat dock, and the Corps of Engineers raised the lake level 8 feet. But fortunately, I could still find the boat dock. So I was able to get a boat and make a measurement there and then change the monitor point to another location from the original proof. Of course, I had to fix all the distances on the original proof because it had been done with 15-minute maps, and the 15-minute maps in that particular part of the West were off by about a quarter of a mile. But
it appears the commission swallowed most of the recommendations of the Band of Five from years ago, but they stopped short on the mathematical modeling using Mini-NEC. Can you tell us what, or can you characterize your discussions with the staff on what their apprehensions are and how they're going to pursue this proposed additional rulemaking inquiry to totally get their hands around that concept, to embrace it? And how long is that going to take, and when are we likely to see that adopted, and in what form? Obviously, there's probably people on the commission staff that wanted to do it and others that didn't, and it'd be interesting to know from your vantage point how that all characterized and fell out.
I can only give opinion, and I'll ask Ben and Bill to fill in any gaps. First of all, realize that this is still an ongoing proceeding. The commission is issuing a further notice of inquiry
Normally,
notice of proposed rulemaking, not notice of
I believe it's further NOI.
No.
No.
Rulemaking.
Further notice of proposed rulemaking.
Okay. Further notice of proposed rulemaking. Normally, if they want to see if there's interest in doing something and get opinions on what should be done, they put out a notice of inquiry, which means tell us what you think. If they process that and decide that it's something they might want to do, they give a notice of proposed rulemaking. Often they give specific rules that they propose and ask for comments, and those are subject to modification. There are people who want to moment method model every directional antenna there is and use an antenna sampling system to monitor its parameters and not have to do field strength proofs on any of them. There are people who want to do field strength proofs on every pattern there is, and both sides have points. I mean, the people who are moment method modeling only will point out that measuring an antenna out in the far field where you get reflections and all kinds of contamination would be like trying to characterize the loudspeaker with it installed in a sampling, so that would make sense to anybody. But then the other side has real good arguments, too. And frankly, I think there are some types of systems that you're not going to monitor well enough with a sampling system to know what they're doing, even though you might have successfully moment method modeled them. And some of those arguments include things like what about self-supporting towers that might have odd current distributions, and what about the stray effects of things at the base of the tower that would affect the current flowing through the toroid? What about using toroid sampling on a tower that's too tall? And the very valid arguments. And to answer that, I think that moment method modeling, I don't think anybody today believes the commission is going to approve doing moment method modeling for every array out there. And I think everybody understands that they'll be building better sampling systems, perhaps with built-in capability for testing and verification, that there's work to be done there. The committee that the NAB held tried to find middle ground that most of the people could agree on. So they kind of went case by case and eliminated. I don't have all the particulars before me. They're a matter of record with the commission. But arrays with large structures very nearby aren't being considered at this point. Arrays with certain, I think there was some specification Ben put on what the taper had to be on a self-supporting tower. Everybody agreed if it's very narrow at the base, we can moment method model it and monitor its parameters okay, but some with odd shapes and different tapers, we're not going to do that. So the joint comments that were filed as a result of the NAB meetings spell all that out. And as I understand it, that's what the commission is actually considering at this point.
Well, there were commission staff people in attendance at the at the dialogues, I guess is the best term for them, that were undertaken at the under the aegis of the NAB.
And I think the further NPRM is required, I think because of how it was after the original comment period, but before the reply comment period, that a lot of this was done, I think, so there wouldn't be any question of impropriety.
I think
has to open it for comments.
I think there's no question about the fact that I think Bill and Ron would agree with me that the presence of the commission staff people at the meetings and their ability to, they didn't necessarily enter in the dialogue, except for providing verification of some of the commission's policies, but they were present for all of that activity, and I think the fact that we were able to come to a consensus about a lot of straightforward cases was had a very profound influence on the staff's attitude about this.
Well, I think too that the commission's point was that if we wanted to get something, we'd need to present a case of how it would work and how it should be administered. In other words, effectively writes draft rules for them is what I took away from it. Because from a regulator's standpoint, in the absence of good information or consensus information, it's much easier to do nothing than to do something bold. And that was kind of what I took away from it. Certainly each side has its view. There are a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who are concerned about the technical aspects of it. But we're also concerned about the economic aspects of it. And at some point, as Ron and Ben have said, should the commission authorize moment method modeling for certain types of arrays, it would then be up to the applicant or the broadcast owner to make the economic decision as to whether to build using that time and effort saving model, or whether the applicant would build something that would require more detailed analysis.
And we have a questioner, but I want to point out something before we get off this topic. If anyone is interested in seeing the comments that were filed and seeing what's gone into this rulemaking thus far and possibly commenting on it at a later date, get on the FCC's webpage, www.fcc.gov, and they have an area you can click on called the ECF comment filing system, I believe. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah.
The docket number to look for is 93177. Docket 93177. If you get into their electronic comment filing system and look up docket 93177 that were filed by the NAB and all of the comments that were filed by the various parties, see for yourself what's going on. Yes, Tom.
Morning. Hi. Just wanted to echo something that you were saying about the monitor points being critical. I found them in experience to be, when you're doing non-directional measurements, your close-ins, to get, as a matter of fact, where I could walk 20 feet and get a reading that's 30-40% different. And what that was going to influence was the inverse distance field, for the radial. That's going to say whether or not this radial is an adjustment. So that can also be critical, because the algorithm that's used by the computer to go into figure what I was doing was choosing points to fit a curve and not choosing a curve to fit points. So it's kind of the opposite.
Torturing the data till it fits.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was another case where, again, another Connecticut station, there was a TV translator that was being put on top of a downtown building. A 20-foot tower was added to like a 5- or 6-story building. The commission required that a partial proof be done on this simple 2-tower station, and the 3 monitor points were in, no problem, except when you go to do an analysis of the partial proof, it looked like a 2.5 to 3 kilowatt array, and the station in question had to go and replace the ground system under the non-directional tower simply because the non-directional efficiency was low. The DA was normal, but even a DA to DA analysis, since the seasons were so different, the station ended up spending a whole heck of a lot of money, which they never would have had to if the sample parameters were fine and so on and so forth, but all because of, something that was just on the periphery, putting a 20-foot tower section on top of an existing building, which would have no influence on the array whatsoever, or common sense would tell you. So in this case, if we did do it by computer modeling, then they would not have had to have...
It's ridiculous sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
One of the things you can do sometimes by computer modeling is get the condition of running a partial proof for some insanely small PCS or cellular structure nearby taken off their requirements, because that their condition on a new construction by another broadcast facility or by a common carrier facility where the construction involved simply mathematically can be demonstrated under the worst possible case wouldn't have any effect, and that can sure save you.
Now they had tried that. The TV station had tried that with the commission, and the commission didn't buy it. They insisted that a partial proof be done. And interestingly enough, this array is near railroad tracks, and when it was first built back in the late 50s, they detuned, I think, like 24 trestles. So in essence, it was a 26-tower array. But those have all since been taken down.